20 years ago, did you think people could make money, have careers running their own websites and blogs, or developing something called artificial intelligence? If you did, how would you have changed how you parented your child? How can the way you parent your kids today affect their readiness for the jobs of tomorrow? Jobs that may not have even been created yet. My guest this morning, Dr. Laura Janna, is a pediatrician who takes the long view on parenting. She's the author of The Toddler Brain. I'm Joe Taylor. The program Contact, the sponsor, Beaver Meadow Creamery. Dr. Janna, it's great to talk to you again. We chatted when you were on with John Poza and me a few months ago, and I'm very happy to have you back on. In my introduction, as well as in publicity for your book, The Toddler Brain, the inference seems to be that we need to parent and educate our kids primarily to fit into future jobs, cogs in the system, I guess. Whatever happened to raising your kids just to be good, decent, happy human beings? And as we were all told by our parents, or I was, and I told my kids, let them find their own passion.
Well, listen, first of all, it's great to join you. And second of all, you just hit the nail on the head for the punchline. Because on the one hand, the toddler brain and a lot of what I talk about and who I speak to are people very concerned about jobs, workforce, what are the jobs of the future, looking at technology and everything else. On the other hand, the good news for parents is what you said in the follow-up to that, which is we're talking about increasing value on things like finding your passion, communication, collaboration, basically playing well with others, as being the skills even more valued for the future workforce. Again, for my purposes as a pediatrician, my focus has never been on growing, you know, raising children to be cogs in the, you know, sort of industrial wheel, right? It's to raise them to be good, contributing members of society, happy, healthy, thriving individuals. The good news is that as we become more driven by technology and exponential change and all these things we hear about, the value placed on those sort of what people think of as good old-fashioned sorts of skills and abilities has become even more important.
You work at the crossroads of pediatrics, education, and business and industry. So when you talk about 65% of the jobs of the future not yet being envisioned, what do you base that on? What kind of research?
Well, it's interesting you bring up the exact specific, that 65% of jobs. You know, I tracked that one down as best I could, and it's interesting because there's so much interest in this area that you take a statistic like that and it gets repeated and repeated and repeated. That particular one, nobody's actually able to find the original source as you really dig deep. But it's been quoted by the Department of Labor and all sorts of places. What is very clear, and it's very easy to track down, is that everyone is looking at just how quickly, you know, the world is changing around us, and that this idea of, you know, if you're going to, from a business standpoint, if you're going to predict 10 years out where you want to be in your career, had you done that just over 10 years ago, you would have missed iPads, iPhones, technology, you know, home computers, because we've seen such a rapid change. So what's very clear is that what's predictable is change. We don't know what those jobs are going to be. Now, when we look at what the driving forces are, technology and artificial intelligence and machine learning, we're seeing a significantly decreased emphasis needing to be put on things like rote memorization, fill in the blank, check the box, right? Or, having a photographic memory is great until you have an iPhone in your pocket, and then it doesn't serve you as well. It doesn't put you very far ahead of anyone else, as opposed to the sorts of skills that I discuss and that I've focused on, which are the, you know, communication and collaboration and teamwork and questioning and curiosity and motivation. Those skills will cross lots of different, you know, as things change, those skills will serve you well across a lot of different realms.
The assumption seems to be that the jobs of the future will be what we now call digital. But I'm reminded a scene from the movie The Graduate. Benjamin is told, plastics, boy, that's where it is. That's where the future is. So isn't it possible that a future growth industry could be something we haven't even thought of yet beyond digital, something that, you know, some, forgive me, nerd in a garage is fooling around with right now? And how could our kids be ready for something like that, something that is totally, totally unimagined today?
Well, that's absolutely the point. And in particular, you know, you mentioned digital. There's two ways to look at sort of the jobs of the future being digital. One is in a very concrete sense, and yes, the idea that knowing how to code and be sort of digitally literate is going to be important seems pretty clear, right? Technology has become pervasive, and it's almost like a language that we need to speak. And in fact, there are whole books on economics written about, I'll give you this short version, you know, the Cliff Notes version is, he or she who interacts with technology wins, okay? So that's sort of that big picture. But the other part of that sort of digital world that we're living in is what I often summarize down into one quick phrase for people who aren't so into the digital technology world, it's the robots are coming.
Right.
And if you think of it that way, you say, okay, what can computers do that humans won't be able to compete? We can't compete now, right? Computational analysis sorts of things. Computers can do really well and really fast and better than humans. Okay? That does not mean that understanding, you know, sort of what I call the IQ skills, the reading, writing, and arithmetic kinds of skills, aren't important, but it does mean that there's an increasing shift and focus onto those skills and abilities that we have that computers can't do. And again, that gets us back to these skills, which I believe, and the case I make in the toddler brain and elsewhere, is that it's not that these soft skills, as people have called them, which I call key skills, QI, it's not that nobody ever thought that, you know, communication and collaboration, teamwork and social emotional skills weren't important, but they're becoming even more important because computers don't do them well. And in a computerized, you know, technology, exponentially fast changing world where we're globalized and complex, it becomes all the more important everywhere I go, in crossing sectors, healthcare, business, you name it. Everyone's talking about the challenges we face are globally complex, the world is rapidly changing, and we must work together to solve, you know, these challenges, right, to rise to the challenge. Think about what skills are needed, and it is not the rote memorization skills of sort of the industrial age and the one-size-fits-all. It is passion, perseverance, overcoming obstacles, adapting to things as they change, and working collaboratively to get there. Does that make sense? Because that's the other part of this sort of digital world we live in, is that it's pushing us much more towards the things that we as humans are uniquely skilled at doing, or have the potential to be, that computers don't.
Most of the innovators and the inventors that I can think of, Edison to Zuckerberg, they march to their own drummer outside of whatever the mainstream science and knowledge of their era was. How can we both program our kids to meet these fields of tomorrow that are coming at us and yet still give them the capacity to think outside the box? You know, there's a body of knowledge now, and I am obviously not a computer person, you know, that this is what you do, this is, you know, what it's all about right now in the digital age. How can we get a kid now to think outside of the box and be a Thomas Edison or, you know, or whoever?
So in your question, you are framing exactly what I was both questioning and then trying to answer in the toddler brain. Because what I saw, you know, I've spent, as a pediatrician, I've obviously spent a lot of time with children of all ages, but I'm also sort of a root cause person. How do we get to sort of the root cause or the source? And let's be intentional, like if we know what we want at the end point. And that's where I started to see this. If we look to, like you said, innovators, you know, Einstein, Zuckerberg, whoever you want to take, there are some things that we know about them. We know about what it takes to be successful, not just in jobs and workforce. That just happens to be the framing that I took to try to compel people who otherwise wouldn't pay attention. But, you know, in health outcomes, in education outcomes, in all, you know, contributing to society sort of outcomes, and work backwards and say, what is it that we would like children to be able to do if we know this is where we want them to end up, being contributing members of society who are thriving, who, you know, are good in the workforce, but also good in all aspects, right, and succeeding by lots of broad definition of the word success. When you say that, it does become a balance, because on the one hand, you know, we as a culture tend to idolize innovators, right? And that is the marching to your own drum and all the things that you mentioned. What I did was I said, okay, let's take a look at some of the things that make people innovative or that define innovators. And for example, one of those things, certainly there's curiosity, right? Be questioning the world and how it works would be sort of one step. And that is where I defined why skills, right? Asking lots of questions. And I said, let's look in early childhood and see what happens with regard to questioning. And what we often find, not everywhere, but it's pretty standard for kids not to get to ask a whole lot of questions in traditional education settings, for example, or very young children. It's seen as sort of pesky and too many questions, and we tend to tell them the answers, right? We want them to memorize answers. To me, that's working backward. That's working towards the 20th century, not the 21st. If you then say, okay, not, it's not just a matter of figuring out how the world works, because that would be sticking within the status quo, but then extending beyond and sort of imagining it, sort of innovation, imagination, creativity realm, which is the march to your own drum, think outside the box. And in that case, kids are really, young children are really good at doing that, right? Playing make-believe and kind of free imagination. And the trick there seems to be not training it out of them, not giving them so many rules and defined sort of boxes to live in that they lose that ability. And in fact, if you look in the adult sort of innovation world, and you can see the head of research for DARPA, right, the military's innovation arm, and you look at the research agency there, and the head of DARPA can be giving a talk and show an image of a 3 or 4 year old looking like they have a Superman cape on because they are so creative and imaginative. That's where, again, you're framing exactly what I've been looking at, is what can we focus on in early childhood that's setting them up for those skills that we'll need, that we know that they'll need in the future.
Let's get down now and talk specifically about the toddler brain. You feel that the first, I've heard 3 years, you're saying 5 years of a kid's life is critical in setting her or his course for life, especially in terms of learning. Why is that? What's going on inside those cute little skulls for those first 5 years that's so important?
Well, sure. And, you know, touching, it's interesting you picked up on this, because if you listen to people, there's a lot of discussion and a lot of interest in the early years, right? So early brain and child development is really rising to the forefront. In terms of 3 versus 5 or even 8 years, here's what I will tell you. The younger, the better. And what happens is you'll find a lot of people focusing on 0 to 3. I did 0 to 5 because I was looking at it from an area that was being left out of the discussion as K-12 education, higher education, job training and skills were all being discussed in the context of these new sort of 21st century demands and skills and challenges. 0 to 5 was being left out of that conversation, so I picked 0 to 5. But what you'll find is that as people are trying to help cultivate these skills and help, you know, do brain building, like intentional brain building, that the 4 and 5 year olds tend not to be quite as neglected, because I think people can envision things like pre-kindergarten. They just think of kindergarten and make it a little younger. Whereas the challenge, both sort of individually, the less you know what's going on inside your child's brain, it's a little more challenging to kind of work with that if you don't understand the early brain and child development. But also from a systems level, how are we going to impact what people do with children ages 0 to 3 that sets them up for success? And that, I've said, has been more like the Wild West, right? It's more one-on-one at home, you know, adult working or interacting with a young child. The other part of the 0 to 3 story is that we know that about 85% of brain growth occurs in those early years. And so this idea that you're laying a foundation right down to the level of connecting neurons in the developing brain, and that we know that it is interactional. The way that you connect neurons in the developing brain is based on how you interact with your child in those early years, means that there's a significant focus there. And that is why I decided to focus. You know, my interest lies, I always say, listen, I'm interested in all children, and by children then becomes families, and families become communities, and it gets broad. And I actually care about them and what happens to them even when they're not children anymore. But 0 to 5 was being left out of the discussion when all the evidence base, whether you pick the brain science, the pediatrics, you know, the health outcomes, or even the economics of where you invest your time, effort, money, all points to the earlier we invest, the better that children have, the better children are in terms of outcomes.
You identify what you call QI skills. Let's define first. What you mean by that term, is it just a juxtaposition of IQ? What exactly is QI?
Sure.
Yeah.
So QI, and you are correct. It is meant to be a juxtaposition or a complement to the what I call the IQ skills. And I actually pronounce the word Q key, intentionally, in the sense that even if someone's not looking at the word written out and they hear me say key, K-E-Y, means that they're important. And I wanted to get the emphasis across that these are really important skills that have been, you know, I guess undervalued, if not overlooked, by many, and that they are the complement to the IQ skills, meaning that it's not that the IQ, the reading, writing, arithmetic-like skills, aren't important, but these other skills are really important. In terms of what they are...
Well, let me stop you right there, because what I want to do, I want to go down these skills, all seven of them, one by one, and I want you to tell me what they are, why they are important, and very importantly, what parents can do to build these skills in their kids. Can we do it that way? Okay, let's do...
Let me just give people a context. I mean, I think it's helpful. The context of the key skills as an overarching category of skills is that they are what people have often referred to, for lack of a better name, there was no name for them, as soft, non-cognitive, and other skills. And the terminology that people have probably heard every day, right, in various contexts, are the things like communication, collaboration, teamwork, adaptability, resilience, emotional intelligence. So there's this laundry list of terms that everyone's hearing about, you know, they're very important, but there was no name for them. Soft doesn't really do them justice.
Sounds rather dismissive when you think about it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So soft is dismissive. Non-cognitive is a misnomer, because it's very much now embedded in the brain science, and we know that it involves complex interactions in the brain and brain development. So that's just plain wrong. And then it leaves us with the word other, which really does nothing to compel people to pay attention to them. So that's where I actually intentionally came up with a new word that people could relate to, which, by the way, has its origins. If I say it's also pronounced chi, people tend to recognize that because it's associated in most people's minds with, you know, Chinese and Asian culture, right? Positive life force, positive energy. But the word has actually been used across cultures and centuries, all meaning some form of positive life force, positive sort of sense. So key skills being a very positive, important part of development and sort of life outcomes is where I got the word key from.
Okay, so let's go down them then. Key skills, chi skills, and again, what they are, why they're important, and very important as far as I'm concerned, and I think most people listening, what can I as a parent or a grandparent do to help build these skills in our kids? Me.
Okay, so we'll start with the me skills. And again, each of these is meant to be that once you hear it, you don't have to go look it up again to understand it or to actually see it in your child or your grandchild and to be able to think about it. So me skills are self-awareness, self-control, impulse control, and mix in some focus and attention. So it's sort of being in control of your own thoughts, feelings, and actions. And here's what we know about me skills, that they have a very rapid rate of development between the ages of 3 and 5, okay? And they fit in a category of what people may have heard mentioned or discussed called executive function skills, which I always say is conveniently named executive function skills if we're linking it to future life outcomes. But being in control and like being able to stop, take a deep breath, you know, resist these impulsive behaviors, you know, parents and grandparents, if you stop and think about it, you know what I'm talking about. You can see it or think about it in simple things like biting, okay, which happens to be the bane of people's existence. You know, I owned a child care center for almost 10 years with 200 students in it. And every year, one of the most popular or unpopular but necessary topics of discussion was biting. If a 2-year-old or a 1-year-old was biting, that's one thing, because you know what? It's an impulsive behavior, and young children, toddlers, don't really have a great control over their impulsive behaviors, and biting just happens to be the least socially acceptable of all of those sort of you could anticipate sorts of behaviors. If a 5-year-old, however, is biting, that's a completely different discussion because we expect 5-year-olds to know better or be able to control themselves. That is me skills in action. It's the I may want something, you may have it, and while my immediate impulsive reaction might be to hit you, push you, take it, or bite you, or some combination of the above, by the age of 5, we have a very definite expectation, and we can see those executive function skills developing very early. So that's where part of this is setting up for the really practical side of that. It's first of all, understanding child development so that you don't get very angry and upset with a one-year-old who bites or hits or pushes or throws a tantrum, understanding that those skills aren't very developed yet. So it would be like yelling at a one-year-old for not tying their shoe, not developmentally where they're at. At the same time, helping children learn to stop, take a breath, modeling that kind of behavior where you don't just fly off the handle, where you help them talk through their emotions so they can be aware of them and start to be in control of them, or you know, learn to be in control, that is all in the ways that you would be cultivating me skills.
Let's go on to we then.
Okay, so we skills is just like it sounds, or as you might guess, those are the people skills. So me was sort of facing internally. We is your working and I always say playing nice with others. Right? So on the one hand, that's basic things. For young children, what does that look like? It's very basic things like use your words, communication, it's playing well with others, learning to share, right? Again, really rapid development between ages 3 and 5. Certainly language starts to appear at age 1, but becoming much more verbal and able to communicate what you're thinking, how you're feeling, and also understand other people, which involves lots of listening, so active listening being one of the skills. It's also perspective taking. And if you think about how much in the sort of, I always say, the big picture world, we think about the importance of empathy and understanding others' perspectives. You could talk about that on the global stage. But for very young children, again, with these we skills, and it is that list of communication, collaboration, teamwork, which I just simply translate into sort of the preschool terminology of put your listening ears on, use your words, learn to play nice with others and in the same sandbox. Those skills, that is why you hear lots of discussion about the importance of social play, you know, and play dates and getting together with other children. That's not so that they can all jump in a room and know immediately how to play well with each other without anybody getting upset or saying something that's not kind or still pushing somebody. That's where they learn and practice those important skills.
Let me ask you a question about that, and I've observed this, and I may have done this as a parent. Your kid is playing with somebody else, another child, and they get selfish, and there's the temptation of the parent to reprimand the kid. I don't know that you want to do that. How do you learn? How do you turn it into a learning experience, make it positive? Because if the first thing is to say, Alexis, my first daughter, she's in her 40s now, you know, don't do that. That's bad. Give it back to Mary.
Sure. And you know, it's not inappropriate to direct a child to do what's right. But what I try to do is get the framing a little different so that your natural reaction, right, all of us as parents, right, we want our kids to behave, be socially, play well with others. And when they don't, that sort of knee-jerk reaction is to get upset with them. But if you think of it as they are learning those skills, it doesn't mean that you let them get away with it, doing things that are inappropriate or that you don't want them to do, but you think about it as a learning experience that takes time and practice. And so that's where instead of being upset with them, you know, you certainly can set things right or you can help them understand. So things like how do you think that made, you know, your friend feel? And starting to kind of articulate, or when you do that, I bet you that made, you know, your friend very upset, or you hurt her feelings.
I don't want to hurt your feelings, but we're going to have to take a quick break. And the next skill is why. You may be asking why, because we have some business to achieve here, and then get back to talking with Dr. Jenna. This is extremely fascinating. Can't wait to pick it up on the other side. Dr. Laura Jenna, pediatrician and author, back very shortly. Welcome back to Contact. I'm Joe Taylor. My guest this morning is Dr. Laura Jenna, author of The Toddler Brain. Back after this from our sponsor. Now, before the break, we were wrapping up playing nice with others. And I had mentioned the temptation to reprimand a child. That is not the way you want to do it if your child is not playing nice with others. And you were talking about a more positive way to do it. Then we'll move on to the next key, which is why. Okay, let's pick it up from where we left off.
Sure, and just to wrap up on the we skills, again, for all of these skills, the idea is if you understand the early brain and child development components of this, it really is like talking to a child, and you wouldn't yell at a one-year-old who can't recite the alphabet, but you would keep saying it to them, and they get to practice it, and they get to sing it, and they get to read about it and things. So, you know, you read out loud to them, and then they start to do it. In the same way, these key skills are really important, but sometimes that sort of anger and upset comes from not understanding when they're supposed to develop. And that's really, in the toddler brain, I actually do this sort of go through what it, does each skill look like in the real world, what does it look like during its foundational development, and what can we, as these sort of caring, responsive adults in our children's or grandchildren's lives, do about it. So that, and to wrap up, me and we, by the way, if you combine those things, which are very easy to remember now, right, no one should have to go look that back up again, just in sort of essence, those two put together are what people know as emotional intelligence, which people have written up in sort of the business journals as two of the hottest words in corporate America, recognizing that they're really important, but they have their foundational development much earlier than most people realize.
And let's go on now to the
why skills.
The word that every parent, if you have a kid anywhere from about 2 to maybe 5, 6, 7, you know, this is nonstop. Why?
Sure.
Let's talk about that.
I picked it as the name of the skill, not because, you know, when we talk about what why skills are first, we're talking about curiosity about how the world works, okay? And so I say, yes, it's the question why, but it's asking all sorts of questions, really to try to figure out how the world works. And children do that very well, but it's also very understandable why that becomes somewhat, I always say, like, you know, a chicken pecking at you. I actually have a little fake chicken sitting on a shelf someone gave me. It's like being pecked to death by a chicken when you get all these questions. The problem is, and this is where when we jump to sort of the business world as our example, just as one of our endpoints, there's actually a training program, high-level training program, that started out being called the 5 Whys, big, you know, global company, and it's an executive training program that's meant to train executives to ask why 5 times. So if you say, why did this happen? They say, this is why. You then say, well, why did that happen? Well, why did that happen? Until you get to the root cause. Like, what is the true reason? Not just the superficial quick answer. Now, that all sounds very straightforward, and that 5 Whys has then become informing a whole bunch of training programs, Lean, Six Sigma, training programs that business people will be very familiar with. Here's my question. Why would we have to train it into adults if we weren't training it out of children?
Boy, that's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, these things are meant to be, it's obvious once I say it, but I fear even for myself, I had 3 kids in 3.5 years. I lived through this, and it's very hard to see it when you're in it unless someone says it to you. So with that in mind, having just said that, the balance here is, you know, you don't want a child who's asking all sorts of questions, interrupting everybody else, can't get, you know, sit through a class, can't do anything. At the same time, go back to your comment about, you know, Steve Jobs and about, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and innovators. You do not want your child to lose that natural, inborn sense of curiosity and questioning. And that's the why skills. So helping keep that, not squelch it, right? You can sometimes direct it. You can help your child learn that there's sometimes a time when it's not the best time to be asking a lot of questions. But unfortunately, a lot of our education system and a lot of our own experiences as children was, you know, stop asking so many questions and just follow directions.
Okay.
And that's where we can really think about that one and cultivate the skill, but sort of within appropriate limits when necessary.
So when somebody says to a kid, stop asking questions, just follow directions, the next key kicks in maybe, and that is will, self-motivation, persistence.
Yes, and it certainly does, because that is, and you'll find when you actually think about the real world, as people, you know, as your listeners start to apply these, because you'll start to see them in everyday activities, both with children, but with adults as well, you'll find that they all sort of blend together, right? It's not entirely distinct. So if you've got a child who's very curious and they want to figure out how to stack blocks from the largest at the bottom to the smallest at the top, but they're young, that ability to just keep trying, right? Keep with it and stick. It's that can-do attitude, the stick with it. Here's what I'll tell you. In terms of that block example, you can picture, right, the blocks where you've got maybe 4 or 5 blocks and you're supposed to have the biggest at the bottom as the base, and then they get smaller and smaller as you go up. And the problem is, if you don't start with the biggest block at the bottom, you've got a problem, right? And adults can see that when they watch someone doing it, right? If you start with, like, the second smallest block and then the smallest block, you're not getting that biggest block to sit on top of it. the tendency, first of all, is to go in and solve that problem for a child. Say, no, wait, you didn't use the biggest block. As opposed to sitting back and letting the child keep trying and figuring it out, and maybe asking some questions like, well, what are you going to do now, right, when they kind of hit a roadblock. And what I've done is there's a video where I've shown that video of a, let's say, 4-year-old in a preschool classroom who's doing that, trying to stack the blocks, isn't getting it right, somebody comes by and knocks it over, repeatedly having to start over and start over until he finally gets it. And it's, let's say it's a minute and a half. That's a long time to watch a child keep trying and trying and trying until he gets it right. Except you know what every business person in the room says? There's the kid I would hire. Right?
Yeah.
I'd hire that kid because we know it when we see it.
Yeah.
Now, here's the point for young children, and this is one really that I had to think hard about, even in the way that I parented, what was going on in my child care center, which is what we know about that internal motivation. It's not just motivation in general, right? But internal motivation, right? Like where you're self-motivated, not from something external. Think about what we do in early childhood, and I'm just going to use potty training as an example. Think of the expression, will pee for M&Ms.
Okay.
Here's the thing.
All right.
M&Ms in that analogy, that in that example is M&Ms are an external reward. Okay?
Right.
So we do a whole lot of, if you do this, I will give you that. I will pay you this. If you eat 2 more bites of broccoli, you can have ice cream. Whatever it might be, what we are doing, and I see this across a lot of early childhood, is we are offering external rewards. You feel good about what you just accomplished because I give you a sticker, some money, some candy, whatever it is. When what you actually want, what we know, and the research for adults, by the way, is really clear on this one in the social psych realm, is it's intrinsic motivation that cultivates creativity and innovation and all these things that we really care about, and extrinsic rewards all but kill it. Right? So extrinsic rewards, I will give you this, I will pay you this, work really well in sort of that industrial mode, assembly line, how many widgets do you want to make, and if you make 5 more, I will give you more. It works well for that kind of world, okay, or that kind of task. But it does not work well for the kinds of things that we've been talking about all, the whole hours, is the, how can you be creative and persistent and come up with new ideas and have a passion. That does not work well. So the idea is that we would like kids to be able to feel rewarded by accomplishing the task itself. And again, I come back to the potty training example. I can't think of a task where the achievement of that task, the reward, is achieving the task itself, right? Congratulations, you don't have to sit in your poop, right?
Right?
As opposed to something extrinsic like M&Ms. And the thing is, if we get kids all the way through early childhood not paying attention, it works in the short term, right? I mean, it has short-term benefits. But in the long run, we end up with a generation, and this is what I was hearing when I sat down to write The Toddler Brain, a generation entering the workforce or in school or in lots of scenarios without the motivation to accomplish a task that might be difficult, right? The first time you meet a challenge, it becomes very difficult because you don't stick with it.
You know, something that occurs to me, and I have this vision of the kid on the potty with the M&Ms. So many of the things that parents are not supposed to do seem to be based on what's convenient at that time for the parent. And don't we need a different mindset in parenting that, hey, wait a minute, this is something serious, something, a project you've taken on, and it can't be that, okay, I got to get this done because I just got to get it done, and really
sure.
Devote your, you know what I'm saying? I'm not articulating it very, very well, but.
I laugh because I've spent over 20 years, I started out in the parenting realm. How do I translate all of this useful information to parents? And in fact, my first book was called Heading Home with Your Newborn, but the subtitle was From Birth to Reality. So what you're describing is the reality of parenthood, right? You enter this reality, and the reality is it's very easy to get buried in clothing, crying, car seats, diapers, sleepless nights.
You just want to get it done. You just want to get it done and be gone with it.
You're just trying to get
through,
and that, it's very demanding. The challenge, and this was the biggest challenge of writing The Toddler Brain, is if that's true on the one hand, but on the other hand, we know that the absolute foundation for all these skills and abilities and sort of way of approaching the world are laid, the foundation is laid in the first 5 years, right down to the connecting of neurons, then it's a disservice for parents if I sit back and I say, listen, but I know you're really busy, so why don't we talk about it once you get through those really demanding early years? Because those early years are such a critical window of opportunity. So that's where what I did and what I've done with the toddler brain and with the key skills is said, let me just give you, here's the quick version. If you just read, you don't have to keep it in your back pocket. It's not a how-to. Every time you want to do something, you look it back up again. It's the, here's a framework to see what you're doing. And it is very much understanding just how busy the early years are. But this is a way, and by the way, what I have found is when parents understand, and we're caregivers, right, child care providers, anyone, grandparents, understand this sort of framework and this sort of worldview of approaching young children and interacting with them, it actually makes it less stressful, more enjoyable, and quite honestly, some of the things that you're doing already with young children, it makes you realize that they have so much more value. I always say, yes, it's warm and fuzzy and cute to talk and sing and coo and read books to babies, but it's way more than that, and that's really sort of inspiring for people who are already kind of just trying to make it through the day, realizing that when they're just making it through the day, they're really laying a good foundation for their children.
Let's move on to the next key, and this one kind of confounds me. Wiggle. Okay. What do you mean by wiggle?
So the easy way to explain wiggle, and I did this somewhat intentionally because I will be honest, in all of my decades of, you know, as a pediatrician, child care, everything, never heard anybody describe a physically restless child in a positive sense, right? It's a challenge when kids are young to have them, you know, touching and poking and grabbing and getting into things, all right? But back to your innovation, this is the best example for when we jump to the world of innovation and wanting to maintain that ability to sort of be imaginative, think of new things outside the box, march to your own drum. Okay, if you read the innovation literature, across the board, innovators are described as physically restless, right? They're out actually interacting with the world, right? And so what I make the point with Wiggle, I decided consciously to do this, was make the point that physical and intellectual restlessness go hand in hand, especially for young children. They're not as verbal. They can't put their words down in paper. They can't do all these other sort of ways of exploring ideas and things. They touch them. They poke them. They smell them. They taste them. They put them in their mouths. That is their exploration of the world. And so the goal here, you know, and I always say, by the way, to get to sort of like future thinking when you said I take the long view is think about how we describe sort of the same concepts in adulthood. It's movers and shakers, the go-getters, the, you know, reach for the stars, spring into action. It is all about movement and go get it, you know, go get it done. In young children, then, the trick becomes, you know, lots of people have said, if at best people have said, you know, help them work their wiggles out, which on the one hand is understandable, but really I think what it is help them learn to put their wiggles to work, because we don't want to train those out of them either, or else they sit back and they don't explore new ways to do things, which really is, and children, by the way, all of us learn best by interacting with the world around us, not just hearing about it, being told about it, or reading about it.
Okay, we have wiggle, and then we have wobble, and I really can relate to this. It is okay to fail, and learning from failure. Let's delve into wobble.
Excellent. So, you know, it was meant to be very relatable, but if you think about it, just like the key skills, when I described all that laundry list of words that people use to describe them, there was and is so much discussion in our rapidly changing world. You know, you don't know what's coming next, so you don't know the way to handle it where you know you're going to get the right answer or the right, you know, the right approach. You want to be able to try things, fail, learn from them, and adapt. So everyone's been talking. Silicon Valley's unofficial motto is fail early, fail often, fail forward. Okay? And in fact, if you know, I now have 3 children in college. So in the last 4 years, I've spent a lot of time with children applying to colleges and things. Do you know that one of the questions on the general college admission test here in the U.S. is, when did you fail and what did you do about it?
That's a great question. Oh, yeah. Really brings out a person's character.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. In a world where, you know, you've got lots of people and you've got accomplishments and you've got sort of fact-based knowledge and things, the challenge really then becomes, what about when you don't get it right? What are you going to do? What strategies? How do you approach it? Do you let it crush you? Now, let's drop early for a minute here. So each of these skills, if people look in the toddler brain, you can actually see for each of the skills, I actually define the developmental milestones, ones that you've heard whenever you've taken a child to the pediatrician and you talk about, you know, are they rolling and sitting. In the same vein, I talk about like their language skills, empathy skills, those sorts of things, and when do they typically develop. And so each of them have their milestones. So then what I typically do now is I ask people, in this case rhetorically, but ask people, okay, so think about what are the developmental milestones in those early years for wobble skills.
Okay? Mm, yeah.
And yeah, and here's the problem. Don't think too hard because there are none. Would you like to know why? Because milestones are successes. And everything we do and the entire way we've framed early childhood development is around successes. And you and I both know that when a child succeeds at doing something, we want them to be first, best, fastest, and we race to post it on social media, right?
Sure, yeah.
Show off your child, right? This is great because they've achieved this, whatever it is. And the problem is that works entirely against this idea of, I'm really proud of my child, not because they got it first or did it best or fastest, but I'm really proud of their ability to keep trying despite failure, not get frustrated, overcome obstacles and adversity. And so it's something to really think about. And I'll give you, you know, this is a good one, an example from my childcare setting, you know, the childcare setting when I owned my school. It's a real challenge when, on the one hand, you know, parents want you to be teaching their children and they want them to accomplish and learn things. It makes it very difficult to be the person to sit back as a teacher and say, oh, guess what? You know, you came to pick up Johnny today and let me just tell you, we did this new task and he tried it 15 times and never got it, so we just put it away and moved on, right?
Yeah.
Because the mentality that we have is I'm paying you so he accomplishes it, right, achieves.
Well, it's also a reflection on me, the parent, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So this is, and what it takes to wobble then, and there are examples, by the way, of wobbling, they're just not milestones, but things like letting a child learn to spoon feed without expecting them to get it correct, you know, correct, or learning to say the alphabet where you don't expect that they can actually do it, but we let them practice it, right? So they're wobbling along, you know, blurring their LMNOPs and whatever else they do. And the other one is toddling. Right? Because if they were doing it well, if they were already successful at it, it wouldn't be called toddling. It would be called walking.
I have to tell you, and I may have mentioned this when we did the show with John Poza. My younger daughter married a Brit. She lives in England, and they gave me my first grandchild about almost a year and a half ago now. And they were visiting last summer, and my namesake, grandkid, little Joe, was crawling like crazy, propping himself up. And I'm, you know, every time since then that I talk to my younger daughter, how's he doing? Is he walking yet? He is, but it took him a long time. And I was starting to get really, really antsy and nervous about it, you know? And I think that is so common among parents. And, you know, you're attaching some kind of failure or concern. And he's,
sure. And the quick answer, especially for something like walking, is you touch base with your pediatrician. Because especially on those motor milestones, right, where it's easiest for people to relate to them, you know, having paid more attention to motor milestones than the social, emotional, and sort of cognitive milestones in the past, is your pediatrician can tell you whether the development, like the muscle tone, all these things that we care about, are on par, or if it's something to do something.
And
about.
He was well within, you know, everything. But again, I guess what I'm getting at is the pressure that we parents and grandparents put on ourselves to just not let the kid, assuming everything else is where it should be, wobble.
If we broaden it, taking that example, let's broaden it. What you've just described is an example of what we need to do is create, so we need to reassure, right? So we need to know that our child does not have a delay, whether it's in walking or talking or whatever else, because in that case, we want to get them early, you know, help.
Sure.
So you touch base with your pediatrician. But when you have the reassurance that you got that that's okay, what you want to do is create a safe environment in which your child can keep trying and practicing and failing and those sorts of things. And it can be in a literal sense, right? They can keep toddling around, right? And you make sure there's no sharp corners for them to fall into.
And I have to say that I think I was definitely more concerned than my daughter and son-in-law. They were, he's doing fine. He's ready. He's getting ready. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was me.
But the other thing is, it does take work on the parents' part for this one, because it also takes time and safe space and some forethought. So, for example, the spoon-feeding example, letting kids practice eating with a spoon. Well, a lot of parents say, well, I haven't let them have a cup or I haven't let them feed themselves yet because I don't want them to make a mess.
He's doing that already. I have video.
Yeah, right. But here's the thing. You need to be willing to let them make a mess because otherwise you're expecting perfection.
Right.
And that's where, and it also takes time. Back to the child who was trying to stack those four blocks. That was will, kept trying, but it's also ability to fail and start over again and think it through. If you give that child the immediate answer because you want them to succeed, right, coming from the goodness of your heart, you are taking away their ability. That doesn't mean just let all kids fail. And again, the other thing I like to point out here is it's not massive failure. Wobble, by the way, I didn't say this at the beginning. Wobble comes, the idea for it comes from Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down.
Right. I remember those. Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't know Weebles, since it sort of dates both of us in terms of, it's something that's been around, for, a toy that's been around for generations, that's an egg-shaped toy weighted at the bottom called a Weeble. And, you know, faces can be painted on it and stuff. There's lots of varieties. But the whole common theme for Weebles are that they wobble back and forth, right? But they never fully tip over because they're weighted at the bottom. So that they always pop back up again. That means it's intelligent risk-taking. It's smart failure. It's not letting your child ride down a hill without a bike helmet on, barefoot with the wind blowing through their hair, right? Because I believe in bike helmets and car seats and all those things. But it is letting a child who's toddle and fall over, just not into a sharp corner. It is letting children run, just not on broken glass or across the highway.
And we need to go on to the final key, the what if. Imagination, creativity.
Yep, and we've already touched on some of these ideas because I always say, what if is like the culmination of the key skills, and it is very much based in brain science and brain development, but it is creativity, imagination, innovation, all these things that we really like and value in today's world. And to define it in ways, so you know, you might say, well, it's kind of a question, and why is questioning, so how is it different? Remember, why is figuring out how the world works. What if is imagining how the world could be and the ability to imagine something that's not immediately in front of you, okay? And so that gets right back to your Steve Jobs creating something that wasn't there before or, you know, whoever, take Alexander Bell or telephone or internet, these things that didn't exist until they did. That could never happen if someone can't imagine anything other than what's right in front of them. So what if skills are really highly valued. Again, kids are really creative and imaginative, and they can picture things that aren't right in front of them, right, and tell creative stories and things as they're getting into that 4 or 5-year-old age range. And in fact, when we do the brain science of this, you can see that young children's brains respond differently to hearing stories read aloud than they do to watching TV or a movie or something. And if you think about what reading aloud does for a child, remember, you can picture this from when you were a child, when you read to your children. They can picture in their mind's eye what you're reading, and they're creating a world of their own in their mind. That is a particular part of the brain. It is a skill, and you want to maintain that for children. The last part of this for what if, just to wrap it up, is I would be remiss if I didn't say that what if also represents hope. Because that's the ability to imagine a world better than the one that you've, you know, or a circumstance better than the one that you've got right in front of you. And whether that's a stressful situation or something really tough or challenging to overcome, or it's you're born into a zip code where your life trajectory is pretty much laid out for you, right, where you know that you don't have a lot of opportunity. If we don't make sure that all children can see a world better than the one they're born into, right, whether it's in the immediate sense or in this larger scale, kids born into poverty, adversity, then we all have problems.
Dr. Laura, I can't thank you enough. This hour has just zipped right by, I'd like to have you come back on. I do a considerable prep for the program, and I haven't even completed the first page. So other things I'd love to talk to you about sometime. Can we do that down the road?
Oh, I would love to. It's been great to join you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Dr. Laura Janna, pediatrician and author of The Toddler Brain. Next week on Contact, we can't let the month of March, Women's History Month, go by without discussing the many achievements too often not recognized that women have made to our world. My guest will be yet-to-be-determined female faculty members. We're working on it from Clarion University. Contact has been brought to you by Beaver Metal Creamery. Contact is always on connectradio.fm. I'm Joe Taylor. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.